Mike.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins.
I for president.
Vote for President Johnson. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
We need President Nixon now more than ever.
Jimmy Carter, a leader for a change.
It's morning again in America.
I was born in a little town called Hope, Arkansas.
There's Al Gore, reinventing himself on television again.
Kerry voted for the Iraq War, opposed it, supported it.
People from every walk of life, uniting in common purpose. Barack Obama.
I am fighting for you.
We will make America great again.
Those are some of the most memorable campaign advertisements in presidential campaigns, starting with Eisenhower in the 1950s through Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Reagan, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and now Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. But what are the influences of campaign advertising in our hyper-partisan environment? What do candidates want to achieve with advertising, and what should voters expect in the air wars in what appears to be one of the most negative campaigns for the White House? We'll look at those questions and more today on Charlotte Talks. Joining me in studio is Dr. Susan Roberts, an associate professor of political science at Davidson College. Dr. Roberts is an expert on American politics with a focus on the presidency, Congress, political parties, campaign strategies, and women's reproductive rights and politics, and is a frequent guest to this show. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you.
Joining us from Philadelphia is Dr. Kathleen Hall Jamison, who serves as the Elizabeth Ware Packard Professor of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School of Communication, where she also serves as director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center. And author of several books, Dr. Jamison studies political communication and is co-author of the most recent book, The Obama Victory: How Media, Money, and Message Shaped the 2008 Election. Welcome, Kathleen.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And from New York City is David Schwartz, who is the chief curator of the Museum of the Moving Images website, The Living Room Candidate, presidential campaign commercials 1952 to 2012. Of over 300 campaign advertisements at the website, he has also gathered a curator's choice of the top presidential advertisements, some of which we'll hear today and discuss. Welcome, David.
Hi, great to be here.
Campaign advertising has become a core staple of modern campaigns and politics. And I want to start off by asking everyone, and Susan, we'll start with you, how do you view the role of campaign advertising, particularly in presidential elections today?
Well, I think that when you look back, there have been themes that have not changed. There was kind of a nice negative, if you look at some of the ones with Nixon. And I think we think of it as going totally towards social media, but I think we just have more outlets for the ads. I was really interested in the audio of the ads because that's what we look at and think we see such visuals in the ads. And they've been there from cartoons all the way up to such sophisticated ads that we're expecting that kind of impact. But I think social media has not diminished the role of television ads. That is still where the viewer gets more of the information. It may not be in front of the television set, but it may be on their mobile device.
Okay. David?
Well, I think, you know, I'm at the Museum of the Moving Image, where we're looking mainly at movies and television. And what's interesting about the commercials is it's the one form of media, you know, where I feel that the candidates have complete control over their message. You know, they're basically making short movies where they choose the music and the images and write the scripts and present the candidate in a certain way. So these commercials really can capsulize a campaign, tell you if a candidate and a campaign has a coherent message, and there's control over what the ad says, and then through the placement of the ads, through how many times the ads are shown and where they're shown, there's a way to control the campaign.
Interesting. Kathleen?
If you eliminated all the rhetoric of campaigns going back to the 1950s and all you had left were the ads, you could actually reconstruct the central images of the campaigns simply by looking at the advertising. They are the core messages of the campaign. They either reassure or they increase your anxiety. They basically do one of two things. Emotionally, you hear that in the tone of the ads. And importantly, they frame questions, the answer to which is a vote for that specific candidate. You usually see that in the tagline at the end of the ad.
Okay.
Right.
So the early ads seem more kind of like commercials for products. David, you know, kind of complete with animations, even kind of a jingle approach. Who had the idea to kind of market presidential campaigns or their candidates this way? How did this, you know, with the advent of television, really begin this process?
Well, Kathleen wrote the definitive book on the subject, Packaging the Presidency, which I want to make sure to plug.
Thank you. She
might not do that. But the credit usually goes to Rawsett Reeves, who was a Madison Avenue executive, who was famous for the M&M melt in your mouth, not in your hands campaign. And it was a number of Madison Avenue ad people who decided that was a good way to spend money in 1952. In 1948, there were just a few hundred thousand television sets in the country. By the time we got to 52, almost 20 million households had television. There were shows like I Love Lucy, and it clearly was a way to reach a lot of people, to buy a short commercial that would run at the beginning, you know, before I Love Lucy. Adlai Stevenson was a Democratic candidate, and his campaign didn't believe in commercials. He thought it was like selling soap. You know, it was beneath the dignity of a presidential candidate to do a commercial. So Stevenson would buy 30-minute blocks of time and deliver speeches. I think they were on like Tuesday nights. You know, the problem being that nobody really wanted to watch those. So it was very effective for Eisenhower. He really defined himself through a series of commercials that year. And since then, every candidate has relied on advertising, although, you know, it'll be interesting when we get to talking about this year because there's something different going on. You know, since 1952, it's just been an essential campaign tool.
Kathleen, when did the campaign start to really step up their ad game in terms of this battle over the air?
The first really sophisticated ad campaign occurs in 1964 when Doyle Dane Birnbach created the Johnson campaign against Goldwater. And in that campaign, you see the most sophisticated work of Madison Avenue amalgamated to a very large amount of money being used to attack a totally inept campaign. That's the campaign that, of course, gave us the Daisy commercial, one of the first instances in which an ad, not aired very often, reached very large audiences because it was so controversial.
Well, we have a clip of that 1964 Daisy ad that I want to run and then come back, and Susan and Kathleen want to talk about the implications of that particular ad.
One, two, three, four, five, seven, six, eight, nine.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one.
These are the stakes: to make a world in which all of God's children can live, or to go into the dark. We must either love each other, or we must die.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
Now, just as a setup, there was a little girl picking a daisy flower and doing the counting of picking off the petals, and then we transition into this ominous voice kind of counting down and a huge nuclear explosion and then President Johnson's words. Susan, what was the impact of that ad, and how did it affect that race?
Well, I think it was pivotal. And one thing I think that as a professor I want to point out is my students almost every student knows about that ad, and even students that are taking American government for the first time. I think it's interesting, too, that you have at the end the dramatic words of Johnson himself. An ad like that today would not be a candidate ad. It would be a super PAC ad. And I think it set the stage for really the visual and the verbal. And I think even the verbal is just as powerful, or less powerful, but it's powerful just like the visual is. And I think it was one that, to me, and Kathleen knows more about this, but it kind of moved the needle in terms of how far you will go and how dramatic and how incendiary, no pun intended, the ad can be.
Kathleen, did it move the needle?
It moved the needle in concert with a whole series of ads that, taken together, created the inference that Barry Goldwater was going to use nuclear weapons casually and, as a result, risk nuclear annihilation. The importance of that ad, however, as a persuasion device, is not simply that it was effective, but that it was effective by drawing on information already in the audience's head. If the audience didn't already think that Goldwater was trigger-happy, and insert that assumption into the ad. The ad never mentions his name, never makes that indictment. Right. The ad would make no sense. The other thing about that ad that's important is it makes no logical sense. The countdown is in English. Johnson is president. If that were the Soviets blowing us up, the countdown would be in Russian.
David, what kind of reaction do folks get when they see that ad, when they view it online nowadays?
Well, first of all, it's a cinematic masterpiece. It's, you know, just a brilliant piece of editing because it just juxtaposes two images, a little innocent girl and then this nuclear countdown. And it's just an ad that once you see it, it stays in your memory forever. It's, you know, the first, like, ultra-negative ad. If you look at the ads from previous campaigns, they were very civil. I mean, there were, you know, some sort of polite attack ads, but to say that if you vote for Goldwater, the world will come to an end, I mean, that's pretty negative, as bad as negative as you can go. So, the other thing that's an important point about that ad is the use of a girl, a little child, which really has an emotional impact that is very strong. And we didn't see children in TV commercials at all. There was the Ivory Girl, and that was about it. And candidates since then have used children very effectively, and we're seeing some of that in Hillary Clinton's ad so far this year.
Okay, we're going to come back and we're going to talk about the Hillary Clinton ad later in the show and the use that she is doing. I want to kind of stick with the 64 ad, the Daisy ad. Would LBJ have used that kind of an ad against any other candidate, or did Goldwater kind of open himself up, and do candidates do that and their opponents use that as a way to attack or to carry out a negative ad?
Well, Kathleen made an important point that something was in the air, which was Goldwater had said that he would consider using tactical nuclear weapons in Vietnam. You know, the most memorable line of his convention speech was extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. So it was set, you know, that ad was responding to what was out there.
Susan?
Well, I think, as Kathleen said, it has to have some resonance with the voter. It doesn't always have to have a kernel of truth, but it has to resonate. And I think if you look at it today, candidates are literally giving their opponents words to use against me. I mean, Bush, read my lips, no new taxes. You couldn't ask for anything more. And so I think that was, the Daisy ad was important because it didn't have the words of Goldwater, but it did play on those sentiments and those fears. And as both in your library at the Living Room Candidate, you have a whole classification called fear.
Okay. All right.
It's a pretty effective emotion.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to come back and talk about the strategy in terms of how these ads have played out, and in particularly more modern ads, particularly Reagan's ad, but modern context in terms of how these ads have developed over time. Joining us is Susan Roberts from Davidson College, Kathleen Hall Jamison from the University of Penn, and also David Schwartz from the Museum of the Moving Image. This is Charlotte Talks.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Culture and Heritage Museums, presenting the Battle of Huck's Defeat at Historic Brattonsville, featuring hands-on activities, personal interactions, and battle reenactments Saturday and Sunday. chmuseums.org. Coming up tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, Charlotte has significant ties to the UK. There are more foreign businesses in Mecklenburg County from the UK than from any other country but one. And the big banks here have large presences there, with London traditionally serving as a financial gateway to Europe. So how will the UK's vote to leave the European Union reverberate in Charlotte? We'll explore that question with guest host Michael Tomczyk when Charlotte Talks, tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
on the next Diane Rehm Show. In the past week, there have been terrorist attacks in Iraq, Bangladesh, Turkey, and other countries, killing hundreds. Connections to ISIS and new security questions for the U.S.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins, and we're talking about campaign advertising and the role that ads have in today's presidential and other elections. We're expecting a down and dirty one for 2016, but we're getting some history along with the strategy. Joining us today is David Schwartz, who's the chief curator of the Museum of the Moving Image, and whose website, The Living Room Candidate, Presidential Campaign Commercials, 1952 to 2012. Also joining us from Philadelphia is Dr. Kathleen Hall Jamison with the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School of Communication, and Dr. Susan Roberts from Davidson College. What's the strategy when a candidate or a campaign decides to run an ad? What are the different types of ads that they could develop, and what's the kind of strategy behind the different techniques? Kathleen, if you could start us off on that question.
There's a standard bio ad, and it answers the question, who are you and what in your background warrants the conclusion that you will do what you promise to do? What are the values that you bring to us as a person? And those are the kinds of ads that ground candidacies. Now, you can get that information elsewhere, and occasionally campaigns don't run them. But ordinarily, a well-run campaign has a strong bio ad, and it answers that question. There are also ads that answer the question, what are you going to do? They're basically policy ads. These are traditional forms of discourse. And then there are the contrast ads that usually pick on something that is a vulnerability of the opponent and either do or do not indicate what the alternative candidate's position is. Sometimes they imply a difference when there actually isn't one. And then there's the pure attack. It finds the vulnerability, and it just lays it down and reinforces it.
Okay. Susan?
Well, and also what I think is interesting, Karl Rove once said, you attack your opponent's strengths and not necessarily the weaknesses. And I think in television campaign ads, we have both. There is that sequencing, bio first, and then the experience, the issues, the attack ads. I think where I get into some gray areas is how to distinguish a compare and contrast, whether or not it's informative or whether or not it's negative. And I think one of the types of ads we've seen in addition to those are the flip-flop ads. I bet you could look back and you'll see those in every sequence of campaigns.
David, what's the most famous flip-flop ads that you have in your collection?
Well, the funniest one was in the Bush versus John Kerry election 2004. It was an ad called Windsurfing. And basically, you know, the Bush campaign early on decided that they would use this flip-flop theme against Kerry, because Kerry had a way of speaking where he seemed to always, bring up both sides of the issue, and had sort of a convoluted way of talking. And so he was, the Bush campaign decided to define him that way. And then Kerry went out during the Republican convention and went out windsurfing, on vacation. And so there was an ad that was cut together with footage of him, flipping around in the wind.
He bragged about voting for the $87 billion to support our troops before he voted against it. John Kerry, whichever way the wind blows.
And it was very witty. It was a funny commercial. And it just drove that message home with a memorable image and piece of music. But there have been flip-flop ads in just about every campaign. It's just really common, and because it uses a candidate's words against them. They're on record saying one thing and then another. So it basically says you can't trust them. They keep changing their minds.
It seems like the ads that get the most attention tend to be the ones that appear to be more negative in nature, that seem to go after the person, the individual candidate, rather than the policies of that candidate. Is that what we have come to expect, and how effective is that strategy? Kathleen, you want to start?
Well, first, I don't like using the word negative because it conflates two different meanings. There is legitimate attack that differentiates the candidates in important ways that forecast governance. And if you call that negative, you're implying that it's somehow illegitimate. If we don't have good attack, that is differentiating attack relevance to governance, we don't have the basis of creating an informed vote. So I try to distinguish between legitimate and illegitimate attack and avoid the word negative, or talk about attack and advocacy as a way of avoiding the word negative. But what is important about the attack function in politics is that it can sharpen the differences between the candidates when it is deployed well. The most effective form, if you care about an informed electorate, however, is the contrast ad that takes a facet of the candidate's record, biography, proposals, and contrasts it with the candidate that is proposing the ad. That gives you a basis for voting for someone, not simply against the opponent.
Susan?
Well, and I like the that helps in that compare and contrast. And I like the distinction of attack ads and not just negative. But one of the questions that people have been asking, it's one side and the other side, is what's the impact of those quote-unquote negative ads? And that is, they found they really don't depress turnout, because people will say, oh, the campaign is so negative, I'm not going to vote. And they actually find, political scientists find, that they do increase knowledge. The ads that are more kind of attack, maybe it's just the compare and contrast. I don't think they've made that many distinctions all the way down. And they do help set the agenda. So there are some things, if you will, that are positive about negative ads. It's proven that candidates really teach something in terms of what these commercials do. And I think that's something that would strike people as counterintuitive.
So, David, how influential are the whole range of ads? I mean, is one type more influential, or is it everything put together that the voter is seeing and hearing in terms of these advertisements?
Well, it's hard to say that an ad will actually determine the outcome of an election. I mean, I think the closest case, you know, the strongest case for that probably would be the 1988 election, you know, where those ads against Dukakis, the tank ride ads about the Boston Harbor, really defined him, and he didn't respond to the ads, and he went way down in the polls and lost that election.
Michael Dukakis says he wants to do for America what he's done for Massachusetts. America can't afford that risk.
It was part of a coordinated media effort. I mean, the ads were part of a whole strategy from the Bush campaign in that year. In 2004, the ads against John Kerry, the Swift Boat ads, which were not official ads, as were done by an independent group, seemed to be very effective. But again, the ads are just a piece of the puzzle. It's a big piece. You know, when people talk about all the money going into campaigns, you know, traditionally the bulk of those hundreds of million dollars being raised has gone into TV advertising.
Are we going to see that potentially again this year in 2016 between Clinton and Trump? Any guesses from folks in terms of how much money is going to be spent just on advertising this year?
This is an odd year for that, right? Because we saw recently the Clinton campaign just did an ad buy of about $20 million in key swing states. The Trump, at the same time, spent zero.
Yeah, well, Susan.
And I think playing off what David said is that there's this tension now that's very strategic between what does the candidate want, what does the consultant say, and absent even talking about Trump, there's a distinction between analytics and data, and then the good the ads over the television, how far do you go and what ads, social media. So I think people are starting to look inside and see what are the differences between the geeks, the new fellows and ladies that have the algorithms, and the gurus, the Karl Roves and the people that know where the bodies are buried and how important each side is. So the strategy is important. And with the money, would all three agree that the more money you have, the more you'll spend, and if television's one of the most effective, then you'll go for broke, so to speak.
One thing I'd be interested to hear about here, say from Kathleen, for example, it seems like many ads in the past like played towards the center. You know, if you look at the ads in the 2000 campaign, there are almost no negative ads. I mean, Bush didn't want to, George W. Bush barely ran any negative ads, and the candidates were both. And there was an ad, I remember an Al Gore ad that's about education that started off with Gore saying, "I agree with George Bush about education." You know, so there was this playing towards the center in most of the TV commercials. And, of course, this year, I think as our discussion started by talking about polarization, it's really a different feeling. We don't see candidates playing towards the middle.
Kathleen, what do you think about predicting for what's coming ahead in the next couple of months?
Well, first, let me go back to 2000. I wrote a book with Dick Johnson and Michael Hagan about the 2000 election based on the National Annenberg Election Survey and an effort to marry the ad buys into that survey data set. The ads made a difference in two areas. The ads that were attacking Gore's trustworthiness, in particular one that quoted him suggesting that he played a determinative role in creating the Internet, helped reduce his trustworthiness in the area in the period coming up to the first debate. And in the final block of the election, Gore had not saved his money for the end. He ran out of advertising dollars. And in the critical state of Florida, Bush substantially out-advertised Gore. In a close election, you can say that that advertising difference in that state probably affected the outcome of the election. So when advertising matters, it occurs when one side doesn't have as much money as the other, has a competent message, and the voters are paying enough attention to be able to absorb the message. What can we expect this year? This year, importantly, one should remember that advertising is simply controlled messaging. And whether you pay for it or not, there are messages that have advertising features. Donald Trump's tweets are essentially ads. Mm-hmm. When the networks move them onto the screen with a tag that says breaking news, and you read that tweet on air, and then they comment on it favorably by saying he's just released that ad, in effect, that message is an ad that he hasn't had to pay for. He didn't pay for much advertising during the primaries, but his free access constituted advertising. When he finally got to Pennsylvania and he was actually airing an ad, the ad simply said what he'd been saying in his stump speeches all along, and those speeches had already been given plenty of free airtime on cable news.
Susan, you...
Well, and I think, as Kathleen well knows about Fact Check, the networks will show 140 characters if they're not going to show for purposes of circulating an ad. But it's very difficult, and they're only starting to figure out how do we fact check on Twitter. And I think, too, if we look at some of these ads that are put out, they have become increasingly negative, but the ad watches don't always give us the accountability that we'd like in both the candidate and the ad. But I think, too, it's a whole new world, but they're going to spend the money on advertising as much as they think they can get the return on the dollar. And I think we'd all agree that there is a return. I mean, people do take away images, and they do recall, and they do resonate.
So advertising this year is going to have to be broadened to more than just over-the-air television, radio. We're going to have to start including social media venues, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube. I mean, how is this going to change the strategy of the candidates, but also how is this going to impact the voters who have to, you know, typically by October, they're wanting to mute their television because they can't stand the ads, particularly for those of us in battleground.
Well, and those that you just mentioned, all the new social media techniques, and we now have the stalkers, the people that go and young persons that have their smartphones, and they will find that that material that they can use negatively. I mean, the wait staff or whoever filmed the 47%
for Mitt Romney.
And so there's more fodder for the negative ads. And there are things that Meerkat and some others that I don't even understand. And they're here and gone, Instagram, Snapchat. and there'll be a new one that comes out this fall. And we can't even anticipate that.
David?
A lot of the videos are from the campaigns are being released on all these different formats. I mean, the Clinton campaign is releasing Instagram videos, and ads are coming out. You know, videos are coming out in all different formats. One thing about the ads, actually, is that it will be one of the few places where we are seeing sort of positive messages and kind of uplifting messages. What we see on the news is, you know, what gets attention on the news are the attacks and the negativity and the back and forth, and it's a pretty harsh campaign. But I, you know, saw some of the Clinton commercials that were released in the past few weeks, and they're very sort of heartwarming. A lot of use of children. You know, a lot of the focus in terms of her biographical ads has to do with the work she's done for on behalf of children. And you know, that sort of imagery is not going to appear on the news. So I think in a way this year the commercials will be one of the few ways where the candidates can get out image, you know, ads that will actually make us feel good.
Okay, Kathleen, and we hope we'll be able to see some of those here in North Carolina and possibly also in Pennsylvania. Both North Carolina and Pennsylvania are considered to be battleground states, particularly for the presidential race. Kathleen, how can advertising impact a competitive race in a swing kind of state like Pennsylvania, like North Carolina?
Micro-targeted advertising can increase the likelihood that specific voters who are not ordinarily likely to vote, but if they vote, will vote for your candidate, will actually go out and cast that vote. When you've got micro-targeted advertising coupled with a strong grassroots strategy, you're delivering absentee ballots to people who are what political scientists would call low-propensity voters. They're not that likely to vote, but they will vote for your candidate because you know that because you've done good research on your electorate. And what that means is that the candidate who's got the money to do that kind of advertising coupled with that kind of grassroots advocacy gets a disproportionate advantage in mobilizing an electorate. It's not in persuading people who don't support you to support you or support the undecided, persuade the undecided, but rather to mobilize those who will vote for you if you can get them to vote. And that's a primary effect of advertising tied to grassroots.
So this is going to be more about mobilization, Susan, do you think, in North Carolina rather than persuasion?
Well, I think in North Carolina, and we look at the broader context, and that is that we now have early voting. A place like North Carolina, we've had so much attention to the changes in ballot access or voting rights. And so I think the first step in North Carolina would be registration. Mm-hmm. Get voters registered. And the second, as we point out, you can only persuade the persuadable. And then the third, kind of the holy trinity, besides registration, persuasion, is mobilization. And I think the two things in North Carolina are going to be getting the voters registered and turning them out, because there's a cohort there that will vote for a particular candidate, and specifically the African-American vote for Hillary Clinton, if they'll get out to vote.
Can candidates go too far in terms of advertising? Can there be a kind of blowback against a candidate if they push the envelope too great with an attack ad, for example? Kathleen, can you?
Yes, we've seen it happen. There was an attack ad by an out-of-state group, a Republican campaign senatorial committee, against Paul Wellstone in Minnesota that overstepped substantially. It was such an egregiously offensive ad that Wellstone's opponent disavowed the ad. The newspapers disavowed the ad. The newspapers editorialized against it. The local television stations ran editorial content disapproving of it. And civic groups stood up and said, this is not the way we want campaigns to happen. That campaign ad hurt the candidate it was trying to help.
Okay. That's Kathleen Hall Jamison at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about campaign ads and what we can expect in 2016 coming up. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru Gastonia. Test drives are available for the new 2016 Crosstrek SUV with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. Coming up next at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, recent terror attacks around the world raising questions about ISIS and security. In the past week, there have been terrorist attacks in Iraq, Bangladesh, Turkey, and other countries, killing hundreds. On The Diane Rehm Show, they'll discuss connections to ISIS and new security questions for the United States. That's The Diane Rehm Show this morning at 10 in about 20 minutes. Here on 90.7 WFAE. We'll have more Charlotte Talks in just a moment.
This week on All Things Considered, we'll explore what it means to be middle class in the most expensive city in America, Manhattan.
When we think about what middle class would be like, I think they would be a little bit more comfortable.
And over the next few months, we'll look at who exactly is in the middle class across the country and why it matters. The new middle, Listen to All Things Considered every afternoon.
I'm Mark Rumsey. Join me for All Things Considered weekdays from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
Everyone is voting for Jack, 'cause he's got what all the rest lack. Everyone wants to back Jack. Jack is on the right track.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer, sitting in for Mike Collins, and we're talking about campaign advertising, and we're going to turn the focus towards the campaign coming up here in the next couple of months between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Recently, the Clinton campaign began an advertising blitz hitting key battleground states, including North Carolina, and it's still 4 months out from the general election. Is this a wise strategy for her against Donald Trump, who hasn't appeared to make a single ad for the general campaign so far? David, what do you see in terms of this approach?
Well, anybody who's going to make predictions about this year, it's a little scary to, you know, it's such an unprecedented year in a lot of ways, but I think the ads are important in terms of defining and framing the election. So I think it's...
Is that giving Clinton then a leg up in terms of these battleground states?
I feel like it should. I mean, we'll see. You know, right now, the polls seem to be indicating that. But it's a combination. It's the ads working in conjunction with news events. You know, so we've had the Orlando attack and then, of course, the Brexit vote. You know, we're seeing candidates responding in real time to, you know, crises around the world. And we saw in the 2008 campaign, one of the strongest commercials in 2008, the Obama-McCain campaign, was when the financial crisis hit in September of 2008. And at a campaign event, McCain said, the fundamentals of the economy are strong. And the Obama campaign came out immediately with an ad using that footage of McCain.
The fundamentals of our economy are strong.
The ad made him look out of touch, you know, like somebody who was just not really in touch with the economic crisis that was going on. So it'll be interesting to see how ads are used to respond to news events that are breaking. You know, it's hard to imagine that there won't be. I mean, there's already been videos from the Clinton campaign using the footage of Trump at the golf course in Scotland.
Okay.
You know, that's similar to the Kerry windsurfing footage, I think.
Okay. We've got the Hillary Clinton campaign ad that's running here in North Carolina.
Through the years, there have been challenges, setbacks, but for Hillary, one thing's never changed. Helping children has been a cause of her life, and it always will be.
Susan, what is that ad trying to do? I mean, we've known Hillary Clinton since 1992. What is this ad trying to do in this campaign?
Well, I think it's a very good ad because it addresses so many of the strengths and weaknesses of the candidate in a very short period of time. It turns what people perceive as her shrillness into a softness and an empathy. It talks about her experience. And I think it does give implicit a nod that says there have been challenges. And you remember there were focus groups that said, should you blame Hillary Clinton because she stuck by her husband? So things have been incredibly convoluted. I think it's a pretty effective ad, and I think it can get to some of the questions about whether or not she's trustworthy. I would also say, as we might talk about later, it hits on the question of how a woman campaigns and the differences between gendered expectations. And now we're talking about women as an important demographic. So it shows her as the mother, the child, caring, the causes that we might expect. And then it throws in there the Secretary of State as well.
Kathleen, how would you rate this commercial?
Well, first, if a commercial gets free airtime on radio or television, it has accomplished something important. And because Hillary Clinton just got free airtime on your station, she has just accomplished something important. When the other side doesn't have ads available to air, you're going to get some news access that you otherwise would not be able to get in an unbalanced format. That's part of the reason that the Swiftboat Veterans for Truth so-called ads attacking John Kerry in 2004 were. Kerry wasn't on the air. And so when the cable networks wanted to talk about the ads, they didn't have a rebuttal ad to put up against it. And the message got an advantage out of that airing. We showed in that election season, using the National Lederberg Election Survey, which is in the field every day, and so we can actually track communication impact, that the impact of that group was not through paid advertising. It was through unpaid airing of its content.
Mm-hmm. So, and I would have to say we would have a Donald Trump ad to air.
I know you would
if
have.
We had one, uh-huh. But the campaign has not quite released one yet. Trump has certainly labeled his opponent as, quote, crooked Hillary. Should we expect in his stump speeches the messages to play out in terms of when he does choose to go up on advertising, on TV, radio, whatever? Should we expect to hear similar themes, David, in terms of the approach that his campaign is going to take?
Yeah, I mean, he's been, you know, I think today he's been using a combination of Twitter and videos. You know, I think he was tweeting out that he was releasing some anti-Hillary videos. So instead of paid commercials, he's using that combination. So we'll see. I mean, it's actually going to be funny. You know, the Living Room Candidate, our website, the way it's structured is we have, you know, ads from one campaign and then the responding ads from the other campaign. So it's going to be a tricky year if we don't see any responding commercials. Let's figure out how to deal with that. That ad you played reminded me of the most effective Hillary Clinton ad from 2008 against Obama, which was a primary commercial, but it was the 3 a.m. ad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where, like, who do you want in office at 3 in the morning when there's a crisis? And it sort of played on this idea of Clinton as being kind of maternal and protective and you know, use that sort of maternalism to her advantage.
It's 3 a.m. and your children are safe and asleep. But there's a phone in the White House and it's ringing. Something's happening in the world. Your vote will decide who answers that call. Whether it's someone who already knows the world's leaders, knows the military, someone tested and ready to lead in a dangerous world. It's 3 a.m. and your children are safe and asleep. Who do you want answering the phone?
Do you think we're going to see a repeat of that potentially with Clinton's campaign strategy of kind of saying Donald Trump is not qualified, he can't handle he almost comes across as a temper tantrum if something explodes in the news or an event happened? Do you foresee potentially seeing that kind of 3 a.m. ad play out again this fall, Susan?
Well, I don't know whether this is legal. But all Hillary Clinton would have to do is take some of the Never Trump ads, the Dump Trump, and from Ted Cruz and others, and she would have that package. There's some ads that are out there that I've seen, and you just can't not look at them. The ad, I think it's called Grace, in which they show the footage of Donald Trump mocking physically the reporter with disabilities. That's a powerful ad. No one can look at that and say, gee, that's okay. I think that's something that maybe, you know, someone just got their feelings hurt. But I think that Donald Trump is going to have a real challenge. Everyone knows that he's trying to be reined in by the Republicans, and he refuses to do that. Hillary Clinton has been campaigning in the general election for months. She has virtually ignored Bernie Sanders, and I think that's a smart decision. But I see Trump as having, there will be no holds barred. There is so much incivility in the campaign today, or in the, you know, what we've seen in the primary campaign, that I shudder to think what will happen in the general election.
I want to go back to 1964 and particularly one ad. We had the infamous Daisy ad, but there was another ad called Convention.
Back in July in San Francisco, the Republicans held a convention. Remember him? He was there. Governor Rockefeller. Before the convention, he said Barry Goldwater's positions can, and I quote, spell disaster for the party and for the country. Or him? Governor Scranton. The day before the convention, he called Goldwaterism a, quote, crazy quilt collection of absurd and dangerous positions. Or this man, Governor Romney. In June, he said Goldwater's nomination would lead to the, quote, suicidal destruction of the Republican Party. So, even if you're a Republican with serious doubts about Barry Goldwater, you're in good company. Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
That was in 1964, and that was using words by Goldwater's, then the Republican nominee, primary opponents in a Johnson ad against Goldwater. Kathleen, could we see the same thing play out? Could we see history repeat itself? It's almost as if you took out San Francisco and put Cleveland in, yeah, they could run the exact same ad.
Well, you also have phenomena this year in which some of those opponents have refused to endorse. And so it's not simply that words are going to be used. The fact of non-endorsement is going to be used. And if any of those candidates swing over and endorse Hillary Clinton, you can bet that that's going to get into advertising. You've already seen the Clinton campaign use the fact of Republican advisors to former Republican presidents endorse in speeches. The question is, will they move that into ads as well? Yes, I expect that this is going to be a year that, like 72, which had Democrats for Nixon, and like 64, which had Republicans for Johnson, you are going to see Republicans for Clinton.
And in 1980, there were the Democrats for Reagan that used, there were some strong ads that used footage of Ted Kennedy attacking Jimmy Carter on the campaign trail.
No more American hostages! No more high interest rates! No more high inflation! And no more Jimmy Carter!
The time is now for strong leadership. Reagan for president.
Well, and with this 24/7 news cycle, we can all say we're watching Fox or MSNBC, and we can see examples, they don't even have to be in ads, of prominent Republicans, of commentators saying, I can't stomach the idea of a Trump presidency. I think that that's important, too. If you look around and say, there's a lot of uncertainty about who should or shouldn't put their name in to be VP. Where are you going to find any surrogates for Donald Trump to go out and campaign? So I think the story's being written even without ads right now.
Well, let me talk a little bit about that. You know, we've been talking about the fact that maybe a campaign can use members of the opposition party to their advantage. The Pew Research Center came out with a recent study that indicates Americans are even more polarized than they have been in their tracking. Will the campaign ads reflect this polarization? And what will these ads do to the environment that we're currently in? Susan, you want to start us off?
Well, I thought it was an amazing study. I've been using their political polarization study from 2013. This is from 2016, just released in June. And it is very powerful indictment of where we are as a nation in terms of party. The people interviewed see the other party as a quote-unquote threat to the nation. They talk about the fact that people are dishonest. They look and say that some of the other members of the other party are immoral. One or two other things, because I just looked at it the other day, they even say they distrust their friends a little bit more. They make an evaluation of their friends if they know their friends are of a different party. The question I don't know is the degree to which party Republican or Democrat will come into the ads themselves, because we have an electorate that have independents. And as you know, your panels know and you know, the independents aren't, they're more leaners than independents. But will they use the word Democrat or Republican to play on this polarization, this culture war?
Kathleen, how do you see the polarization playing out in campaign advertising coming up?
I think there's a countervailing tendency, which is instead of defining this in terms of left and right, to define the world in terms of establishment and those who would change the establishment. And if you look at the profile of the Sanders voter and the Trump voter, what you see are people who aren't really defining left and right, which is the way we traditionally see the polarization, but rather defining we against they. The establishment disadvantages us. We have been left out. It's a different kind of divide. And in some ways, it cuts across polarization because you can feel polarized and left out, but you can also feel disaffection for both sides and simply out of the dialogue. And the question for those people is, do they vote or not? And if they vote this year, for whom do they vote? Important to remember that we have unprecedented negatives right now for both candidates who are major party nominees. That's not actually the profile of a polarized electorate. A polarized electorate would think the other side is really bad, but my side is really good. There are a reasonable number of people are saying my side's pretty bad and the other side's even worse. I'm not sure either side is acceptable.
So we're basically going to be running on the politics of I can't stand the other side or I hate the other side more than my own side. And is this a way to run an election?
Well, and the anger is just not limited to partisans or ideology. I mean, the anger is so multifaceted. Sometimes it's specific. Sometimes it's general. Sometimes anti-establishment. Sometimes it's build a wall. Sometimes you're angry at the water in Flint, Michigan. I mean, it's so, it's the environment. The environment is toxic. As Kathleen said, it just doesn't have to do with parties itself.
We're coming up to the end of the show, but I just want to get a brief glimpse. When does everybody think they're going to see the first Trump ads being run? And is it going to be an attack ad? Is it going to be a positive ad? What's your predictions? I know this is an unpredictable year. Susan,
well,
start us off.
I pretty much gave up predicting when I thought after Trump insulted McCain, he was dead flat out. I think it may be in a month or so, or right before or after the convention. There's still a chance that something could happen at the convention.
Okay. All right. David?
Well, I was going to say the same thing. I think at the convention is where we have to be introduced to the sort of positive and uplifting pro-Trump story.
Let me go to Kathleen here real quick.
Oh, they're already on the air. Their independent expenditure ads, very strong attacks against Hillary Clinton.
That was Kathleen Hall Jamison at the University of Pennsylvania, joining us with David Schwartz, who is the chief curator of the Museum of Moving Images, and Dr. Susan Roberts from Davidson College. Thank you all very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks
a lot.
Charlotte Talks.